one of the best things of discussing any presentation by Professor Mamdani is that it makes your work very easy. So my only response to his 40-minute lecture can only be summarized in 2 minutes to say that I agree with everything he says and I go away. But I guess that would be unacceptable, otherwise why did you come? First of all, I must tell you that I am the odd man out on this table. I am the only one who will never be professor of anything. And my good friend Charlotte, with whom we were in school, is heading towards becoming a professor. I'm busy heading in the opposite direction. Still struggling to get a second degree, so you understand why. But maybe I will try and do my best in town so that if I make history, maybe professor will write about me, and that way I'll get the best choice. I've had the privilege of being associated with Professor Mamdani since 1992. That's when we first had our interaction. And my gray hair says how old I am. And amongst all the praises that he's been given, he's the one person who has had the distinct reputation of bringing life to a stop in 3 cities on the African continent. It's a good thing his brother Anis is here. He'll tell you that whenever there was a lecture or a debate involving Professor Mamdani, life in Dar es Salaam would stop and everybody would go to Dar es Salaam University. That's before all of you here were born. In the late 80s and early 90s, when you heard a rumor, because at that time the media was not as developed as it is now, when you heard a rumor that Professor Mamdani was going to give a lecture at Makerere University, you came and inquired if that was true. Then nobody worked that afternoon. Then he left Kampala and went to Cape Town, did exactly the same thing, didn't find much tolerance there, and they shipped him off to the US where he, life goes on for other reasons. And so when he reached there, he got married, he got a child, and he became normal like the rest of us. So, and his hair became darker. There was one thing while we were at Makerere. I used to be at the Faculty of Law. Professor was then a professor of political science here. And while I was a student at the Faculty of Law, where the deputy vice chancellor was my teacher, if you quoted from Professor Mamdani, the most famous book of his being Politics and Class Formation, if in your coursework you quoted Professor Mamdani, you were sure to fail. Because of a long-running intellectual rivalry that started at the University of Dar es Salaam on what has been famously called the national question between Professor Mamdani and Professor Dani Wadada Nabudere. So Makerere was divided by this road you see down here. The people up on this side of Makerere quoted religiously from Mamdani, and if you didn't, you wouldn't pass. And the ones on the lower side of the Faculty of Law quoted from Nabudere, and if you didn't, you wouldn't pass. And if you quoted either, you were sure to fail. So I am really happy that now we can associate freely and I can come here to debate with him the national question. And I hope that I'll be able to do it justice. I think the best that I can do is try and see if I can respond to some of the questions that he raises. One of which is the question of Pan-African unity. And perhaps nowhere is that question raised through the crucible of Sudan in more ways than one. First of all, the question of whether countries as they are defined today should even be divided. But there is even the question of whether Pan-Africanism has and can actually be achieved in Sudan. Because it raises for me not just the question of what is the self, But even the very basic question that we have never resolved on this continent, which is the question of Africanness. Who is an African? You see, there are people who refer to themselves as Ugandans, born and live in the UK or the US. And then there is Professor Mamdani. So is Africanness a question of race? Or is it a question of, as Professor likes to say, citizenship now? It's his favorite line of argument. And I think that that question has come up in Sudan. Other people in the North, Africans or Arabs? And I think for us to even answer the question you raise about Pan-African unity, we need to start from that basic question, because there is a sense in which the people who live in the southern part of Sudan see themselves as the authentic Africans. Some of us feel that sometimes the people who live on the northern side of this continent only come here because it's the easiest way to win football trophies. Now, then there is the question that he raises about how to write the North-South history. I think really, Professor, it's fairly straightforward. The conflict that you talk about, that dates back to the history that you so well enumerated, is really for me a question of control over the resources of that part of Africa and how they should be organized and who should appropriate them. Whether it is the question of slavery, whether it is over the question of land, and today the question of oil. It is primarily a question of who controls those resources. And that is why you have the most thorny issue left out of the referendum in southern Sudan, which is who controls Abyei. That's what it comes down to. After years of conflict, and I'll talk about some of the reasons why these people gave up on, first of all, the crusade of Arabizing the whole country, then of exporting Islam by force right up to Kampala, which then failed, and why one very important person, who, Professor, you don't mention at all, and I would have been interested to hear what you think of him, is a man called Ali Osman Taha, who in racial terms is much darker than our own president here. So you sometimes wonder about these classifications. But Ali Osman Taha represents the ideological wing of the northern establishment that is now in charge. And why does he find it necessary to compromise? I think that it is more than just a question of his analysis of 9/11. I think he realizes that the only way he can guarantee that they control the resources and try and build a much stronger establishment in the north is that they don't waste money on a war in the south that they're not going to win. And so he finds an exit strategy that everybody can take advantage of. So when you have that history, you then raise the question of SPLA or SPLM as a champion of unity. And I think that, one, in the history of humankind, we sometimes neglect the role of individuals. And I think, or sometimes we try to downplay it and look for what we call the objective forces that run the historical process. I think that one of the most interesting people on the African continent, whose impact has not been debated, Professor, I forgot that I was coming to meet you today, I would have brought you a new book, but is a man called Julius Nyerere. And I don't know how many of you have ever heard of him or even read about him. You're all obsessed with Nelson Mandela, and sometimes you never realize how much that man single-handedly shaped the history of the African continent. And that the thinking of people like John Garang and the positions that they take on nationhood, the progressive position, is largely influenced by their time and the thinking and the philosophy of Julius Nyerere. So it's not accidental or a flash of brilliance that people like John Garang shaped the movement of SPLM around the question of a reformed, unified Sudan. It is because they have a history and are coming from a particular political experience that shapes their worldview, and therefore they design that Sudan must remain a viable national state, united, but going in a particular ideological direction. So when he dies, before this question is resolved, the logical conclusion of that process is for the individuals left behind to resolve it in the best way possible. Which then requires us to look at the history of Salva Kiir and the other players that have led this process. We forget, or some of us may not be aware, that actually John Garang was not the leader of the second rebellion in the South. He's not the one who led the rebellion. It was organized by Salva Kiir and led by, I think, somebody called Kerubino Kwanyin Ball or somebody like that. So the individuals were completely different. But the establishment in the North, desperate to avert another war, decided to send John Garang as an emissary because he's the most senior southerner in the Northern Army, if I may call it that, to try and talk to his people to come back into the fold. When Garang goes back, he realizes this is an opportunity to lead something much bigger, because obviously he also had his own issues. So he asks for a month, in which he thinks it's the amount of time he requires to resolve the conflict, the original mutiny, then leads a march out of Southern Sudan, and SPLM is born as a political movement. But the original revolt against the Northern establishment was actually started by completely different players. And these are players who do not have the experience, political experience and ideological worldview of John Garang. So now they are left on their own. I am not surprised that the logical conclusion is to say, look, let's resolve this the way we had originally wanted to resolve it in the very first place. So that to me explains the shift of SPLA from the original program. And by the way, it's believed that if John Garang had not died, this referendum would not have decided on a separate state, because John Garang would have insisted on standing as the first southerner to contest a free election in Sudan and win it. In fact, he was so sure of victory, he told Ali Osman Taha at the signing of the CPA that as a symbol of his victory, he would build a brewery in the northern part, just to make the point. Well, but that would mean that they would have free access to beer. So, I just wanted to make, I don't know how much time I have left, but I wanted to make some other quick notes that, yes, Professor, the outcome of Southern Sudan, in a sense, was shaped, or the political process was shaped outside the geographical context, in the sense that you have the influence of Julius Nyerere, you have the influence of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe in terms of shaping the fortunes of SPLM. You have the involvement of Uganda and Kenya actively seeking an outcome in Southern Sudan, Uganda largely driven by local politics and security, Kenya largely driven by economic interest. So, these, in a sense, have also given birth and shaped that particular internal dynamic in Southern Sudan. So the American entry is really driven largely by their oil interests, is really supporting and, in a sense, has allowed these other players to become clients of the so-called external process. There was the issue of whether there was a military victory or a stalemate. It is actually true that there was a military victory. The Sudanese army was actually defeated in Juba, and that is when a discussion started. Because after fighting and trying to force SPLA out of Southern Sudan, trying to overrun everybody right up to Johannesburg, it became clear that as a military enterprise that was no longer possible. Therefore, it is necessary to accept that you cannot, even just the sheer, even if we can contest whether militarily that did happen factually or not, the fact of accepting that the military option was not possible was in itself an acceptance of defeat. But I have spoken to two Ugandan generals who I know are involved in that process, and they will tell you the maneuvers and what eventually led, first of all, to the original handshake that took place in conference center here between John Garang and Omar al-Bashir, but also the realization that the military option was not available to the North and that they had to come and talk. And actually, if you read, there is a book, biography by a retired Kenyan Lieutenant General Subeo, you will see, if you read his biography, he was very deeply involved in the resolving that conflict. You can see that it became clear that not only would they not win, it was actually possible that Juba would have been overrun, because even these, these other forces that were being used, the LRA, there was another couple of militias being used, could no longer hold the process. Of course, there were other, as I said, external forces militarily fighting. There is the involvement of Ethiopia, which we haven't discussed at all. There was the factor of Eritrea and so on. So, I think that for me, therefore, and I also would have liked, and maybe point out here that Professor, you talked about the question of democratization. And first of all, maybe let's talk about what does this referendum do? I think what it does is it wipes the slate clean and gives the people in the geographical location of southern Sudan the opportunity to review how much they are willing to concede to be governed by another group of people, but also importantly, to review this self that we talked about. Whether they will achieve it is another matter, but that's what it gives them the opportunity to do. Which brings me to the question of democratization. Democratization, sometimes when I listen to the debate in Uganda, it's as if democratization is an end in itself, that once you have all these trappings of democratization, you have therefore democratized and that's enough, or if I don't win an election, then it's not democratic. I think that there must be an outcome from democratization, and that's one of the things that I hope is debated in Southern Sudan, or the New Sudan as it's being called. That democratization must necessarily, first of all, lead to the people in that area freely conceding to the manner in which they should be governed, freely and regularly, every number of years. Number two, that they participate meaningfully and actively in how public resources are allocated, organized, appropriated, and allocated to the greater public good. If those issues are not defined, there will be another war, even if you have elections regularly, because the process itself has not allowed people to participate freely in how resources are shared out amongst the population to their greatest benefit. In conclusion, therefore, I think that as we debate these matters, we must give a benefit of the doubt to the players and not be sometimes when you're seated in a controlled environment like the university and you're debating, you can be tempted into being very harsh with your criticism. But let us remember that the people who are shaping the events that we are debating don't have the benefit, one, of the hindsight that we get, or even the privilege of thinking as they shape these events, because they're dealing with dynamic situations, forces that they have to shape and manage, and sometimes these forces are larger than them. And if you look at the forces, I don't know of any country, maybe Zimbabwe today or South Africa some many years ago, that has had to face the kinds of forces that Sudan faces today. I went out of naivety and sheer recklessness. I took a trip into southern Sudan by road not the usual sign that Ugandans like going, which is to go to Juba by air 1.5 hours or drive through a nice road. I went through Kitgum and wound up 70 miles inside Sudan at a place called Pajok. And you've got to understand that this is a part of the world that is pretty much in the Stone Age. And I am not saying this to insult them. I am telling you the geographical reality and economic situation that's there. There are no roads, there's no modern infrastructure. The people have not had an education for over 25 years. These are the people you are expecting to try and build a modern state that is functional. And you analyze them with the skills and intellectual approach that we take on countries that are already fully developed. I think we're going to have to be patient with those people. They're going to make worse mistakes than we think. I think we should know the context that we're dealing with. I went in there, we drove for 2 days, and we had to open roads in order to reach our destination, and slept at a place that had been abandoned by Norwegians 7 years earlier. Number two, we should understand that these people are deprived of the benefit of hindsight. Some of them never even live to know the consequences of their actions. So I think we should try, not just, I'm not talking about professor, but as we consume and pick interest in this new country that's coming in, we need to understand that it is not a South Africa. This is not 1994. We're talking about starting from scratch, a place where there is no hospitals, they're just scrub bushes, and where their intellectual resources are scattered all over the world, except in their own country. Finally, because of my long association with Professor Mamdani, I am hugely disappointed that this is not a typical Mamdani paper. We are not used to, I think old age does something to people. They become mellow, and Professor, I am really angry because you've gone into the softer issues of life. You know, this whole citizenship thing, identity, and what happened to, first of all, good old materialism? You know, that you may not like it because it's probably no longer fashionable, but it explained things in a real and concrete way. And for me, that is still the real issue. The fourth thing is not about identity. It's not about residence. It's about ownership and control of the resources. And the contest is how they should be managed, for whose benefit. And for you to omit that is for you to run away from your identity, Professor. Thank you very much.